Good evening and welcome to session 371. No, that's not. 372, sorry. The Public Faces of Mormonism, Polygamists, Past and Present. We have on the panel today, and Ann Wild will go first. And Ann, let me get... Ann Wild was born and raised in the LDS Church, coming from generations of prominent Mormons and pioneer ancestors. She graduated with honors at BYU in business and education, and she considered herself a fundamentalist Mormon for over 40 years. With her husband, Ogden Kraut, they had authored together 65 books on LDS history and doctrine. And as a side note, the very first non-Orthodox, non-church Deseret book that I ever bought in my life and read happened to be Ogden Kraut's Principles and Prophets, an excellent book introducing someone to the concepts of polygamy. And I also would like to, I get a little bit ahead of myself, I also would like to remind you to turn your cell phones off or pagers. If you have one with you, just take a second, just like me, and open it up. Look, make sure it's on vibrate or on silent. The biggest part about that is that if someone's listening to the tape at home and someone's cell phone takes off and rings, here we generally can still hear what the person's saying, but if you're listening to it on tape, you ever hear a session and someone's cell phone goes off, you can't hear sometimes what the speaker or whatever is saying, so it's a good idea to turn off your cell phone or pager or whatever you have at Noisemaker at this time. We also have on the panel David Pace. And David is currently the Director of Development for the Ryer Woodbury Dance Company in Salt Lake City, Utah. I guess that's a fairly new thing, and that's a great thing. He lives with his wife, Cheryl, and has been married since 1992. And David I've met a few times over in the past, and he has this distinction of being one of those rare people who can wear a hat and look really good in it. A lot of people just wear hats from time to time when they cover their heads, but he always looks really sharp in a hat, and that's one of the things I know about him. Brooke Adams, we have right next to David. She is works with, it has it incorrectly in the program that she's the religion reporter. She actually has a specific beat of polygamy for the Salt Lake Tribune, and that specifically is her topic. Or her work that she does on a full-time basis and has done so for a year and a half or so. On the very end past Anne is Linda Chatwin, and she's an attorney who, in addition to general business clients, represents various interests for polygamous communities, including the Centennial Park Action Committee, in their work to bring awareness to the needs of polygamous people and culture, and I believe she'll be speaking second. And we'll go ahead and start with Anne, who's going to turn around and speak to us first.
I was really glad when I heard that the theme for this year's symposium was the public faces of Mormonism. It seems like outside the state of Utah, the public face of Mormonism, when you ask them what do they think of about Mormonism or Utah, the answer comes back as polygamy. So when I talked to Dan, I said, I hope you're having some kind of a panel on polygamy, because that is really one of the major conceptions that people have when they think about Mormonism is polygamy, whether it's good or bad. Unfortunately, most of it is the stereotypes and the media that has presented some of the not-so-positive sides of polygamy. So about 6 or 7 years ago, a few of us got together and decided, you know, enough of this negative stuff. We wanted to present the other side. So three of us, plural wives, have been actively involved in explaining and defending our polygamous beliefs and lifestyle. At first, it was a real leap of faith, but along the way, we have seen progress in how others are more realistically perceiving plural marriage between consenting adults. Our public face began in December of 2000 when Mary Batchelor, Mary Ann Watson, and myself published a book entitled Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. Because of our this decision to speak out publicly, we've had countless media interviews, especially with worldwide media, during the 2002 Olympics. The story went around that the media would come here from all over the world, and they'd go to local media or officials, and they'd say, where are the venues and where are the polygamists? So this is, again, the public perception that a lot of people have about polygamy and Utah. Then in the same, well, the following year, we put out Mormon Focus magazine. And then in the fall of 2003, three of us plus Linda Kelch started Principal Voices of Polygamy, which has now just been shortened to Principal Voices. We have been an advocacy group to help others better understand our lifestyle and to build bridges and with state government and social service organizations. Progress has been significant and very rewarding at times, but it's difficult to overcome the stereotypes and the stigma attached to plural marriage, especially in the state of Utah. I think most people are beginning to recognize the diversity, however, that exists within our culture and not paint us all with the same brush. What I have selected to do today for my presentation is present excerpts from about five different media, mostly television, that has represented our public face. I've selected these from those that have been televised over the past 18 months. These have provided us with opportunities to present a more accurate picture of contemporary polygamy between consenting adults based on early Mormon doctrines. This 10-minute presentation includes national TV excerpts that have been taken from DVD copies of the entire shows that we had recorded along the way. Sometimes jumps a little awkwardly because one of them especially is a little bit amateur video, but I wanted you to get the feel of some of the things that have been done publicly to try and change the image that has been out there for so long. The first one that I'm showing is the Larry King Live Show. We were on this, three of us, on April 6th of last year. We were asked to be a part of the segment on this show, and when they asked us to be on, of course, they wanted to fly us somewhere, and the three of us are very busy, and we didn't have time to go flying somewhere. So they consented to have a satellite come to my house, and it was immediately converted into a television studio, moving the furniture, and the kitchen became a makeup room. But it was really an amazing experience because that show is so popular. It's not quite time to put that on yet. Is it just... No, I'm just going to tell a little bit about it first. Thank you. And then, without interruption, we'll just see the excerpts. So, several other people were also on the show, and they were satellite. And so you had kind of a pro and con show on that one. The second one is the Youth and Family Rally, which a coalition group put together of different polygamous groups. It was 15 young people that volunteered to talk about their lifestyle in a polygamous family. They volunteered. They were not asked or forced. This was something they wanted to do themselves. They represented four of the larger polygamous groups, including the independents. And there were a lot of media that came, both local and national, and there were about 350 people in the audience. It made a real impression on people because they hadn't heard from the teenagers themselves. The Keith Ablow Show is a third one. Several teenagers, one brave husband, and assorted plural wives were invited to be guests on the Keith Ablow Show in New York City. Dr. Keith is a noted psychiatrist, similar to Dr. Phil, if you haven't heard of him. And he was very favorable in his comments about how we live this lifestyle. This was the first trip to New York City for a lot of these teenagers, in fact, most of them. And we just happened to be there on the fifth anniversary of 9/11. So we spent that whole day with my cousin being the tour guide, who's a native of New York, and we just had a phenomenal time. One comment I wanted to make here, after the taping of the show, one of the cameramen came up to me and said, quote, "You have every right to be proud of what you have done here today." So I think we really made a difference in what we said that day. The fourth one is an excerpt from Mormon Stories, which is John DeLynn's podcast that he's been doing a series of. I was included in a three-hour interview And I've talked to John, and he said that there were thousands of people that watched that podcast, and he had pretty much nothing but favorable response to it, which I was very pleased about. And then the last excerpt will be from the Big Love promotional documentaries. In order to advertise their second season of this HBO series, they did 2 half-hour documentaries, and they asked me to get some people together that they could interview about our response to that program. And so we have the finished product. Well, first of all, they're titled Big Love, Big Secrets and Family Go Figure, and you can get those on HBO On Demand. But the finished product showed interviews with the creators, the writers, the actors, and 5 of us. So we'll start with the DVD excerpts. I don't have any comments that I'll need to make during that, but you'll kind of get an idea of what our public face has tried to be for the last little while.
Harry King Live. Good evening. In the early days of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons, polygamous marriage wasn't only sanctioned, it was highly regarded. But when the Church changed its policy on polygamy and banned it in the late 1800s, not everybody went along. And today, there are an estimated 37,000 people who still practice plural marriage. That segment's from John Quinones' specials on this. Joining us now, all in Salt Lake City, Utah, are Mary, she does not want to give her full name, currently in a plural marriage, also a member of the Apostolic United Brethren, also known as the All Red Group. This is her first time going public. Mary, and then Anne Wild is the co-founder and community relations director of Principal Voices, co-author of Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. And Mary Batchelor entered a polygamous relationship about 16 years ago, has 7 children, ranging in age from 1 to 15, executive director of Principal Voices and co-author of Voices in Harmony. What do you do that you don't agree with?
Well, I don't agree with underage marriages. I don't agree with arranged marriages. Part of the work that we do with Principal Voices is that we actually help open doors to some of the communities and put them in touch with resources and with the state. So that they can come to the table and represent themselves, but also to open a dialogue. When we have a dialogue open, people can clear up misconceptions and also be educated.
Does that make you glad, Anne Wild?
That people are moving out and it's increasing?
Yeah.
I feel really bad for this situation down there, and I know there's a lot of problems, but I want people to realize that there's such a diversity that, you know, it kind of reminds me of the blind men's story trying to describe an elephant, and each one feels a different part. I think that's what's happened here tonight, is each one of us is describing a different part of plural marriage based on our own experience or based on experiences of others near to them. But I do want people to know there are thousands of people, at least, that are very happy, that have freely chosen it as consenting adults, and they do not have a lot of the problems that have been talked about tonight.
First, I'd like to welcome everyone here and thank you for coming out, supporting our kids. I should say our youth, because they are young men and women, and we're really excited to have them here.
Hello, my name is Tyler. I'm 19 years old, and I've lived in a polygamous culture for most of my life. I have made the choice to Sunday live this principle, and I don't expect you to understand the reasons for this choice, but I do expect you to defend my right to make that choice.
Yay!
Yeah. This is a choice so many people have made in the past. And because they've made this choice, they've been alienated. They've been persecuted and prosecuted, but their resolve remains. Mankind has always persecuted what they don't understand. Sadly, that has been a natural reaction to anything that challenges the status quo. But because you are ignorant of something is no reason to want to destroy it. Understanding and reason are two of our greatest tools as human beings. In the heart of every American is written the immortal second sentence of the Declaration of Independence. This promise has been a source of hope and a vision for a better life for immigrants from all over the world. But because of our beliefs, we have been denied this promise. Because of their beliefs, many of our people have been incarcerated and have had many of their basic human rights stripped from them, namely life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I did not come here today to ask for your permission to live my beliefs. I shouldn't have to. I came here to defend a principle I hold so dear. As Thomas Paine once wrote, "The time of the sunshine patriot and the summer soldier is over. These are the times that try men's souls." Thank you.
Hi, my name is Catherine. I am 16 years old. There are a lot of negative myths told to the public about my family's lifestyle that are simply not true. I have never experienced any of these horror stories I've heard in the media, nor do I know anyone who has. I was raised in the Salt Lake Valley by parents that gave me a wonderful childhood, teaching me strong moral beliefs about freedom of choice and respect for others. One of my strongest beliefs, given to me by my parents, was the belief that everyone should have the right to choose their mates and what lifestyle they believe is right for them. Along with that, the belief that one must be educated to make wise decisions. Because of the help and support of my family, my father, and all of my friends, I was able to graduate from high school 2 years early and am currently attending college. We are not brainwashed, mistreated, neglected, malnourished, illiterate, defective, or dysfunctional. Productive members of society.
Welcome, everybody. Very special topic today. Today we're going to go inside the minds of polygamists. These are people who choose to have more than one spouse, even though it's against the law. So they're risking, in some cases, imprisonment in order to express what they believe is a lifestyle that gives them very rich rewards. Rachel, tell me your story.
I, too, was raised up in the polygamous lifestyle. My parents lived it, and it gave me a lot of support growing up. I wanted the same thing for my children. It is a very deep religious belief that we have, but as I started to grow up, and I fell in love with a man, and he was a married man.
Today we met families who have a very different structure than most of ours. They practice polygamy. And I've had my ear tuned for any hint that that lifestyle injures their children, because I care deeply that we protect children. I just didn't hear anything today that really truly concerned me, other than the unfortunate prejudice that has for generations been focused on these people. We may not understand them. We may not choose to live the way they live. But I can't see any reason anybody would hate them. Again, the first priority for any good family is the well-being of their children. The people we've met today seem to care deeply about their children. They've got a story, and they've had the courage to tell it here today.
Hello, Ann Wild.
Hello, John.
Thank you for coming on Mormon Stories.
Thank you for asking me.
So, for our listeners who aren't up to speed on that history, would you mind taking us through, LDS and Mormon polygamy history through your eyes?
Okay. Well, initially, of course, it was a Bible doctrine. We were taking it back into the Old Testament with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses, a lot of the early prophets had plural wives. And so when Joseph Smith was about to restore the gospel directly from the Lord, I believe, one of the principles and ordinances that was revealed to him was that of plural marriage.
By the end of the season last year, I started feeling kind of like the Job character in the Bible. It's just, how much can you heap on this guy, and he still kind of comes back for more. Bill Henriksen is an American businessman, entrepreneur with ambitions and dreams.
and maybe even an empire builder. But just like all of us, it does take you away from your family. And that's why I think people relate to Big Love. Because even
by decriminalizing it, it just means you remove the criminal penalty, but it doesn't mean that you have to get a legal license every time you take another wife.
And watching Big Love, that made me think about when Nikki has to fill out that application, or when she's filling it out and she says, "I got stuck on marital status." I mean, how many times have I got stuck on marital status?
How realistic is that?
I generally end up just marking that I'm single or not married, because it is true that the state doesn't recognize, and usually the places where I'm filling out doesn't recognize my marriage as anything legal.
Bill, don't love me for me. I'm just a baby factory, aren't I?
How could you think that?
I'd be the ugly pregnant wife from now on. I'm going to be a fat and slovenly and have stretch marks, and I'm going to smell like crevices and sour milk.
Decriminalization would be wonderful.
Footage of the rally.
Because I was raised with grandparents that went to prison for their beliefs, and so that does get passed on through generations. But I would love it. I would love there to be no fear and more openness about how we believe and how we can portray ourselves.
You know, there's
well, that kind of gives you a sample of some of the things we've been involved in for the past year or two. In dealing with the media, we have been very careful excuse me, about those with whom we consent to do interviews. We avoid sensational television programs, tabloids, reality shows, and on the other hand, we are very grateful for those reporters who represent us accurately and fairly and help us to get our message out to the public. We could not do much without them. In fact, we could never even begin to pay for all of the TV and newspaper media coverage that we've had. Our message in coming out publicly like this is sixfold. Linda, do you want to stick that up? It just kind of happened to fall in the ABCs and DEFs, but in presenting these different media things or presentations to the government, we want to acknowledge the diversity. And that is really important, because when you hear media coverage about FLDS or Warren Jeffs, we want people to understand that that is only less than one-fourth of the total number of people that consider themselves to be fundamentalist Mormons. We try to build bridges between our community and government agencies and social services. We have had to also to train and educate our own people about certain issues, about services that they are entitled to, and then also at the same time to help the Attorney General's office and other people understand more about our culture, that just because we're polygamists doesn't mean we're criminals. We try to correct the stereotypes, because people automatically assume that women are uneducated, suppressed, and barefoot and pregnant every year. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case. We want people to know that we are there to protect our families and to educate them. This really, when you get right down to it, polygamy is all, Mormon polygamy, the way we live it, is all about families. And there is not abusive in conduct regarding our children. We encourage equal rights. I don't know if this is common knowledge, but, you know, if somebody were to have a job and the boss would find out that this man had more than one wife, he could be fired. The family could be living in a home, and the landlord could say, "Well, I'm sorry, if you have more than one wife, you can't live there anymore." To me, that's very unfair, and I feel like we should be entitled to equal civil rights just like any other minority. And then eventually, which is a long-term goal, we would like to foster decriminalization, which is different than legalization. We don't want to, I think I explained that on one of the clips there, we do not necessarily encourage legalization, because we don't want to feel like we have to go get a legal marriage license for every plural wife that we take. But decriminalization means that you just remove the criminal penalty from that. So our public faces have also included the political arena, and we successfully lobbied up at the state capitol a few years ago and got the wording of a bill changed. We've also been noted and reported on in newspapers and magazines, and Brooke Adams has been very fair in her reporting of our culture, and we do appreciate her. Hopefully, our willingness to communicate, participate, and educate will open doors to better public understanding. As a growing alternative lifestyle, we feel we are entitled to equal civil rights, the same as anyone else. Today, we add our public voices to those of 6,000 LDS women who, in 1870, held mass meetings throughout Utah in defense of plural marriage. We feel the same as Eliza R. Snow when she said in one of these meetings, quote, "There is a point at which silence is no longer a virtue. We speak not only because we have the right, but justice and humanity demand that we should." Thank you.
In several of the various polygamous groups. Because of the work that I do, I was invited to make a presentation at Columbia University. And in the course of doing my research for that presentation, I found that... Are you unable to hear?
It won't pick up on the tape if you don't speak.
Oh, okay. I'm just getting some feedback, so... Like this? Okay. So as I did my research for that presentation, I felt that it was meaningful to give some background on what the law did that brought the anti-polygamous statutes onto the books. And I was actually quite amazed at some of the activities that took place, and so I thought it would be helpful to give a little information and background on that. Okay, is that good? All right, so the first one is the Reynolds versus U.S. case. That was in 1879. And here the question was whether religious belief can be accepted as justification for an overt act made criminal by the law of the land. This case gave Thomas Jefferson's views that religion is really between man and his God. And so, therefore, the court found that polygamy was odious and an offense against society. So people were perfectly entitled to hold their beliefs, but they were not entitled to practice them. And then on the heels of that, in March of 1882, we had the Edmonds Act. This made a crime of cohabitating with more than one woman, but it was targeted to polygamy. So other people could cohabit with more than one woman, and there were not prosecutions, but under polygamy there was. Believers of polygamy were ineligible for jury service. Polygamists and their spouses were not able to vote or hold office. And women were imprisoned if they did not testify against their husbands. During this period, there were approximately 12,000 polygamous people that were disenfranchised in this country. If that wasn't bad enough, in 1887, the Edmonds-Tucker Act was passed, where not only were the provisions of the Edmonds Act retained, but witnesses could now be attached without previous subpoena. So any federal prosecutor could come to a plural wife's door, knock on it, and say, "Come, you must testify right now." Children that were born 9 months after this act became effective, children that were born in polygamy, were declared illegitimate and were not entitled to inherit their father's property. Women's suffrage was abolished in the territory of Utah. And the self-defense options that the territory had were also eliminated, so they could not maintain their own militia. They had to accept a federal militia, and there was no naturalization of LDS immigrants allowed. So, coming forward to a little bit more current time, we had the State versus Holm case. Rodney Holm was a police officer in Hilldale, Utah. He had charges of bigamy brought against him. He was stripped of his right to be a police officer, but he was also found guilty of bigamy and did serve jail time. He then appealed his case to the Utah Supreme Court, and in that case we find that Utah had a real moral dilemma. Judge Nearing, who was part of the majority, stated what the true dilemma was, which is Utah will forever be shackled to the practice of polygamy. And I suspect that I'm not the only person who has speculated what the consequences might be were the highest court of this state to provide constitutional protection to those who practice polygamy. Chief Justice Durham gave a vigorous dissent, and she stated that while cohabitation of unmarried couples is commonplace in society today, including those who may be married to another, criminal penalties are imposed on those who do so for religious purposes. And the majority concludes that private consensual behavior of two individuals who do not claim legal marriage somehow harms the institution of marriage. So polygamists ask themselves, why are we different than those under the gay lifestyle? Yes?
How old was the plural wife informed?
She was 16 at the time that she was married, which was not illegal at that point. That was a law that was passed at a later time. But under Lawrence versus Texas, if you take out gay here and put in polygamy, why not? Okay? The statutes do seek to control a personal relationship that, whether or not entitled to formal recognition of the law, is within the liberty of persons to choose without being punished as criminals. And the state cannot single out one identifiable class of citizens for punishment that does not apply to everyone else, with moral disapproval as the only asserted state interest for that law. This runs contrary to the values of the Constitution under any standard of review. Okay, so polygamy doesn't automatically equal abuse and incest. And in fact, Christine Durham in that home case says, the state has provided no evidence of a causal relationship or even a strong correlation between those who practice polygamy, whether religiously motivated or not, and the offenses of incest, sexual assault, statutory rape, and the failure to pay child support. And we also hear a book review that came out very recently on the John Llewellyn book, published on www.amazon.com, that says decriminalization of polygamy does not decriminalize child abuse or welfare abuse any more than continued legalization of monogamy makes any such abuses legally permissible. Additionally, decriminalization would make it far easier for any victim in the abuse in polygamy to come forward without fear of further prosecution of themselves or family members for being polygamists. So why do fundamentalists embrace this principle? Well, they have deeply held religious convictions. We find in the Millennial Star in 1885, Congress demands repudiation of our entire religious practice today. And inasmuch as polygamy is, in Mormon belief, the basis of the condition of a future life, it asks them to give up their hopes of salvation hereafter. Joseph Smith said, "They accuse me of polygamy and of being a false prophet. But I am no false prophet. I am no imposter. The same God that has thus far dictated to me gave me this revelation and commandment. He said to me that unless I accepted it and introduced it and practiced it, I, together with my people, would be damned and cut off from this time henceforth." Now, fundamentalist Mormons believe that these principles still apply to them. They cannot be in a position where they're deprived of their rights to eternal life. And so, therefore, they find themselves having to practice civil disobedience, if you will. Today's environment, we find that Jonathan Turley, who's a Shapiro professor at George Washington Law School, says, "A person can live with multiple partners and even sire children so long as they do not marry. However, when that same person accepts that responsibility and makes a legal commitment to those partners as a spouse, we jail them. He says, if we yield to our impulse and single out one hated minority, the First Amendment becomes little more than hype, and we become little more than hypocrites. For my part, I would rather have a neighbor with different spouses than a country with different standards for its citizens. And this man goes on to say that polygamy is not a way of life that he countenances, but he can see the religious freedoms that ought to be allowed in this country. Now I have a personal story that I wanted to just share that I ran into with, as I worked with the groups that I've worked with. And I'll tell you at the outset that I have, in my work, I've been really involved in a lot of child advocacy issues. And I was recently involved in a very emotional issue that I'm going to ask you to please excuse me if during giving this story I become a little emotional myself. So I'm going to try. I just want to give you a little bit of background. Centennial Park is established in 1986. It's located 3 miles from the Utah-Arizona border, has approximately 1,500 residents, and the Work of Jesus Christ is what they call themselves. They believe in the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and the teachings of Joseph Smith. This personal story is as a result of the raids that were taking place during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And during those times, public and private agencies were trying to take families apart and to discontinue the practice of polygamy. And we find that that didn't work. So this story, I'm going to kind of just read. It's in the words of Dorothy herself. She was 6 years old when her father was arrested on charges of legal cohabitation. In her words, "My perfect little life of a child growing up on a farm was suddenly shattered. Not only had I lost my dad, but now the family was faced with the real possibility that the children would be taken from their mothers and sent to live in other states. Our father was a very sweet, gentle person, and our mothers did not fight. In fact, they were very good friends." Excuse me, I need to keep up. Prior to the arrest, neighbors pretended to be census takers and came into our home to get evidence to be used against us. The trauma of having our father forcibly removed from us, which we all witnessed, was only the beginning. My mothers had to go to work to support the family, and it became known throughout the neighborhood that we were polygamists. We were pestered and teased at school. Kids would harass us and throw things at us on the way home from school. Before he went to jail, he had a family picture taken so that he could keep it with him in his cell. Only the first wife and the children were allowed to visit him. I remember as a six-year-old mother telling me and the other three children that lived with her that if we were taken away, to come back to Utah one day and find the family. I remember how frightened I was at the thought of possibly losing everyone and everything I knew. After almost 3 years, he was released and came home to his families, knowing that he could be rearrested at any time for the same offense. Because he chose to keep his wives and children together rather than scatter them, he was rearrested 8 years later. He was kept in his cell this time for 22 hours a day, suffering from cold, and only received 2 meals per day. He was prohibited from writing to his plural wives, so he sent messages to them through letters to his children. The embarrassment and abuse did not stop there, but trickled down through the children. At the time of the second arrest, I was an associate editor of the high school newspaper and a correspondent from my school to the Salt Lake Tribune newspaper. When his picture came out on the front page, I was fired from the correspondent position and never received my last paycheck. This infuriated the journalism teacher, who allowed me to submit my final article under another girl's name. I later discovered that this journalism teacher was the daughter of George Reynolds, the renowned polygamy case. After paying his debt to society, my father came out of prison the second time. He remarked that he had paid a tenth of his life for his beliefs. Prison life exacted a heavy toll on his health and that of his family. He died at the age of 69. Many of the families living polygamy today tell similar stories of love and hardship. Throughout the history of Utah and Arizona, some 1,300 men and women suffered similar arrests and imprisonment because they were devoted to each other, their families, and their religious beliefs. So the current law enforcement activities have brought some harsh memories back to these people, and they're very anxious to have an understanding from society at large and the ability to just live their lives and not have to worry about legal repercussions. Thank you for your time.
I'd like to thank the panel for their comments thus far, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm not sure why I'm here. I wrote an article that appeared in Sunstone a few years ago about called The Kingdom of Tom Green. And so my approach is, and I'm a personal essayist and a fiction writer, so my comments come to you through my memories as a mainstream Latter-day Saint who eventually left the church formally and considers himself an ethnic Mormon, a non-religious Mormon. So, Mike, the essay that I wrote really answered the question that the New York Times magazine, Sunday magazine, asked, which is, why the persistence of polygamy? And I saw in my own past and in what was going on at the current time with Tom Green, my own complicity in the furtherance, or the persistence, rather, of polygamy. All of that to say that I have no qualms, I have no problems with modern-day Mormon polygamists. But what I'm curious about is how the mainstream church and those of us in the underbelly of the mainstream LDS church, where I find myself, how we help hold this practice in place still. And I think that there's a lot of lessons to learn from the persistence of polygamy, and in particular the case of Tom Green, who incidentally this week was released from prison. I don't remember how many years he's been there, but it's been a while, six years. So I have memories very early on when I was shortly married and very unhappily married, I might add. So I say that because I did not want a second wife. I didn't even think I wanted a first one. And at the time, it was the Camas bombing, if you remember, with Adam Swap and the wife of John Singer. And I remember rooting for the guy with more than one wife, and I couldn't understand where that was coming from. I was very active in the church at the time, living in West Valley. And I found myself in that familiar Mormon state of mind called the siege mentality. And everybody who had invaded us, from the Federal Bureau of Investigation to the New York Times and other newspapers and media, I felt were my enemy. And this is from somebody who is comes from a devout Mormon family, a mainstream Mormon family, LDS family. So that was the first thing that I recalled. And then I remembered this John John Singer story when I was in high school. And I remember watching TV, and my mother, who was the mother of 11 at the time, soon to be 12, be the mother of 12, was stirring spaghetti. And I believe it was KSL came on, and they were interviewing the child of John Singer, one of the girls. And they asked him, what are you going to do if something bad happens to your daddy? Because, you know, things were heating up in terms of the confrontation with the state authorities. And she says, oh, nothing will happen to my daddy. God will protect him. And then, of course, they immediately followed with the story that John Singer had been shot in the back on his own property. And I think that was the first time that I realized in my mother the Mormon schizophrenia over polygamy. That was when she dashed to the phone, called KSL, and told them that under no circumstances should you discredit the faith of a child on television. And that interview needs to be taken out for the 10 o'clock news. And it was. My mother was very firm. So that's another incident. And then I started asking myself, you know, these questions. And I think the short answer about why Mormon polygamy persists, whether it should or not, is that, quite frankly, that dusty beam in the basement that needs to be remodeled is a load-bearing beam. You can't take it out. And nobody wants to admit to that. But so I've come up with four reasons why I think polygamy persists and how mainstream Mormons are complicit in that, as well as people like me. I think there's something primally attractive in the rectitude of practicing polygamists. They are preparing for our return to Missouri and the millennium. They thirst, as I did, for something more than what we got in the institutional church, which Alan Roberts once described as going through sixth grade every year. We are free, and this is the point that I wanted to make. We are free, and I mean Mormons, Latter-day Saints, and non-religious Mormons like me. We are free not to practice this strange principle because we know that there are those who can and those who will. Reminded me of when I was a flight attendant for Delta Airlines. I was flying to Tel Aviv in late night flights, and I was talking to this Jewish woman who was snacking on prosciutto and, you know, a secular Jew and going to the Holy Land. And she told me, she says, I'm really grateful for the religious Jews and the religious Jews in the Holy Land who are living the law, because that means I can live in New York City, snack on prosciutto, and not live the law. Thank God there's somebody doing it, because then I don't have to. So anyway, that's one reason why I think we turn away from prosecuting and have in the past, although we seem to be individuals, I think, are prosecuting them, obviously, in the case of Tom Green and others. Number two, it makes us different. And I think we want to be different. We want to assimilate into the United States of America and that culture, but we really, really have an investment in being peculiar. And this allows us to be that way. And this allows us to be seen as the fulfillment of God's narrative in this new promised land. So we do. We allow this to happen. I think part of it, number three, is that we're nostalgic for the extended family, which none of us, Mormon or non-Mormon, have anymore. We barely have a nuclear family of that. I think we look at those old photos, those old sepia-toned photos with children spilling out of them, and I think we get nostalgic. I come from polygamous stock, and I was the our family from my father's side comes from the second wife. Thank goodness, because if I'd come from the first wife, Clifton Jolly was talking in the other room the other day, and he says, I found out my family's actually from the first wife, and I'm scandalized now because I want to be a real polygamist. I want to come from the second wife. Of course, he's converted to Judaism, so what does he know? And finally, I think we can't help it. It's in our hard wiring. And, you know, there's this whole tradition of lying for the Lord that happened during the just after the manifesto. And I think that Mormons have a problem with that still. I think we're dishonest people. And I think that the lying for the Lord about polygamy has transmogrified into lying for public relations now. I think that we perform for each other nonstop in our wards to the point that we have started to believe the lies. And I'm not talking about the restoration. The restoration is not a lie. The restoration is just a religion. Sorry, those of you that are believers. I just think it's another religion. But we believe in the lies that I think were epitomized by Tom Green, who was deluded himself in thinking that he could go public. The crime that Tom Green committed was not polygamy. It was not lying about polygamy and keeping quiet about it. We couldn't handle that as a people here. So we took him to task. And some of those lies that I want to list, and I think that, I don't know if they play out in the fundamentalist communities, but I suspect they do, but these are the lies. That it's us versus them. That we live in this taught paradigm where we are inoculated from the world and everything is them versus us. We believe we are Christian without acknowledging what generally accepted Christianity looks like. We believe everything marital or sexual that Joseph Smith did was sanctioned by God. We believe the way to deal with our past is to deny its complicated shadings. And finally, and most importantly perhaps, we believe our motives are immune from dark needs. And I include myself in that. I was the one that showed up at my family reunion with a Polygamy Porter t-shirt on, thinking that I was so courageous to walk into my Orthodox Mormon family and show them that I was above it all and I had a sense of irony about this polygamy thing and so forth and so on, when really I was just offending the crap out of them. So the insensitivity of that, the insensitivity of all of us as we live these lies and think that we are somehow above it all and more courageous than the practicing Mormon or the fundamentalist Mormon or the non-religious Mormon like me, I think we deserve each other. So on that very grim note, I close. Thank you.
That was pretty provocative. I think you should ask your questions now, probably. I think I'm going to start by telling you how I began covering polygamy for the Salt Lake Tribune. About a year and a half ago, I was called into one of the top editor's offices, and he explained to me that they wanted me to take this as a full-time beat. And I was taken back by that. The reason for that was that there was so much going on, particularly with the FLDS community in the southern part of the state, that the newspaper wanted somebody who would have depth and understanding that they could bring to the stories. But this seemed like a pretty perplexing challenge for me, and I asked if I could think about it, and he told me I had 5 minutes. And I thought, okay, I guess that's what I'll be doing. So, and I feel like it's a privilege to be able to cover this subject right now, because I think we're at a really significant historical moment that is fascinating to get to be on the front lines and watch and record and know that someday scholars are going to be looking at all your stories and figuring out what you did and what went on. So So my challenge is to try to put a public face on polygamy in the news media, which is very, very difficult for all the reasons you've just heard. These are people you're writing about, people who really don't want to be in the media. And they not only don't really want to talk to you, if you try to photograph them, it's impossible. It's even tougher. And one of the most interesting things for me to realize when I started to do this beat was that it's even tougher to be a reporter in Utah trying to cover this story than it is to be a reporter from somewhere else in the country or the world, because people are most reluctant to tell their stories right here in their own neighborhoods. And that has just been a big challenge for me, and I've complained to many of the people sitting in the office, how can that be? But the memory is very, very long here about how they were treated by Utah media during all the raids. And so I as a reporter am still living with the legacy of that, I believe. And to put some context on that challenge, sometimes it's taken me, and I'm not kidding, a year or two to get people to agree to do stories. Even when they're things that you might think are innocuous, like I discovered, and I had bought a packet of wildflower seeds at a local nursery and happened to flip it over and notice that it was a company in Hilldale, Utah. And I thought, well, now that's interesting. We hear all these things about people on welfare and in polygamy and who aren't supporting themselves and these poor, oppressed women. And I thought, but here's a woman who obviously has her own enterprise. What a great story to be able to tell. Took me a year and a half to talk her into that story. But I can be a pretty patient person. I've really learned that, too. One of the other interesting things, many of you in this room have been part of this phenomenon of women in polygamy stepping forward to tell their story and to defend their lifestyle. And but the men have been, for obvious reasons, much more reluctant to do that. And I would say that is one of the issues that I hear the most criticism about from readers. Where are the men? And, you know, just yesterday I was talking to a writer for Entertainment Weekly who was quite intrigued that I have this full-time beat. And at some point in the conversation, that very issue came up. Where are the men? Do they really think it'll cost them their jobs and their livelihoods? And I had to try to explain, yes, they really believe that, and it very well may. And then one of the other reactions that I've had from readers of some of my stories, for example, I wrote earlier, or just a couple of months ago, about a suburban family, plural family. And that was one of those stories that took me months of negotiating to get them to do it, although many members of this family had been on national media. They were still very reluctant to tell the story and put their faces out to any degree right here in their own community. So I consider that a neutral story, or you could say it's a positive story. Here's a family, it's a glimpse into their lifestyle, about how it works and why they do it. And there was quite, some readers had a very negative reaction to that story and challenged me directly about why I would be reporting on something that's illegal. And I find that a really strange question, because we in the media write about all kinds of things that are illegal or contrary to law. And we have over the years, whether that's, you know, the civil rights movement or whatever. So, or undocumented residents right now, too, immigrants. So I get kind of perplexed by that. But the thing I've come to realize is that stories like that challenge people's perceptions and worldviews, and that's an uncomfortable position for many people to be in. Let's see. So one of the things that I've also learned in the year and a half or so that I've been doing this full-time, and I had covered polygamy part-time somewhat before that as well, is how much diversity there is in this lifestyle, and I wish that I were able to show more of that and to let my readers see some of the differences between the groups. So I think that would be helpful in moving away from a stereotypical portrait of polygamy that we tend to have. And then maybe, you know, and I will say this is like the most difficult beat or subject I've ever had to try to write about, because so many people, because I feel like I can only get some part of the story so often. And that is so true, particularly when you're writing about the FLDS group, the group led by Warren Jeffs. Those people do not, you know, talk to you. They won't be quoted. I've had some very interesting experiences there. Well, I might go into a city office and be treated very well and friendly by a member of that group, but then if I'm standing in line next to them at one of their local restaurants, they won't even acknowledge that they've ever seen me before. So I feel really troubled as a reporter by the fact that I have to write about that group, and yet I can't get them to talk to me and tell me their side of the story or to give me access to information about them. And although, you know, I mentioned there's a lot of positive things that I've been able to see among plural families, I'm sure if I had the access, I would see some of that there too. And I just want to mention one experience and reaction I had when I did, I covered the rally where many of the teens spoke. And two things happened to me at that were pretty interesting. One of them was that I had mothers come up to me with a daughter or son in tow and say, "This is my child," which is something that generally they would not acknowledge to you. They don't acknowledge their family relationships, and that's, you know, not the way it is, obviously, if I go out into a monogamous family to tell a story about them. And it just really struck me. And at one point in that rally, I had five young teenage girls come, and they put their arms around each other, and they said, "We're sisters." And that was another moment where I thought, they don't do that publicly. And how, you know, it would just really hit me that they have to live in society unable to show their family relationships so much. So I try to get that out, to do some of that in my reporting, be able to try to show these people as people. So that's it.
Linda, I had a really quick question for you first. When you did you research the federal legislation against polygamy? How did you start that research, and did you use the web as a tool to do any of that?
I certainly used the web. During the law school, when I went to law school, we had several cases that we studied in law school.
Can you come up here and answer that?
Yeah, the question was, how did I do my research? And the answer was, yes, I used the internet and just personal knowledge because of when I was in law school. I attended law school a little late in life. My husband passed away, and I found myself really needing to find another course in life, so I went to law school in the 1990s. And at that time, there was a case in the Utah Supreme Court of individual by the name of Von Fisher who was involved in polygamy, and he had taken a plural wife who then passed away from cancer, and she had children that needed to be provided for, and there was no custody arrangements for the children, so the sisters of the plural wife challenged them staying within the family that they were in, and it went to the court in St. George, Utah, who found that the Fishers had no right to adopt these children because they were engaged in polygamy. It was appealed to the Utah State Court of Appeals, which also upheld the St. George finding, but then it was also appealed to the Utah Supreme Court, who found that the polygamous people certainly did have standing to adopt children. And in fact, they found that the best interests of the children were certainly served in staying within that family, that the family was a good, honest, hardworking family. The decision is public, so you can find it. But we studied that in law school. And then I also took a class called Religion and the First Amendment, taught by Michael McConnell, who's now our Tenth Circuit Court Justice. And in the course of that experience, he brought to light the Reynolds case and all the things that were going on to disenfranchise the LDS Church. And I was quite astounded to find out that the federal government was able to really disenfranchise the whole church and escheat all of the church property to the United States. And so when I received this invitation at Columbia, I thought, well, that would be a good thing to research and really see what the statutes were that were put into place.
Actually, that was a really small fishing expedition on my part. I was thinking that there might have been a little bit of serendipity because I happen to have a website with a fairly long chronology of federal legislation against polygamy that's been there since 1996. And it turned out serendipity doesn't always happen, but I had two little anecdotes, and then we'll start with the questions. My involvement in polygamy, not as a participant, but as a student of polygamy, happened when I was rather young. And I remember one time asking my grandmother. We come from a small town, Lyman, Wyoming, 6 miles away from Fort Bridger. It was settled in 1903 or 04, something like that. And it happened to be settled by settlers from Minersville, Utah. And my grandfather was one of the original pioneers in Lyman. And his name is James Henry Rollins. He is the brother of Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner Smith Young. And so she's apparently, she was married to a non-Mormon who Joseph Smith took her as a plural wife. And he died in the Lyman. He died and was buried in the Lyman Cemetery. And I remember when we were little kids, we'd go to the cemetery all the time, and my parents and our aunt or grandma or whatever would take us over and say, here's John Henry's grave. And I go, big deal, who's he? I had no idea that a contemporary of Joseph Smith was buried in our, was the first person buried in our town cemetery. And he also worked as a clerk in Joseph Smith's store in Kirtland in Jackson County and also in Nauvoo. And I asked my grandmother one day, why were there any polygamists that lived in Lyman? And she thought for a moment and said, I think Bishop Bruff had a wife on one end of town and another wife on the other end of town. Many years after she passed away, doing genealogy, I realized that her grandfather was a polygamist. She didn't mention that her grandfather, she's mentioned one person in the whole town that lived polygamy. She didn't mention her grandfather living polygamy. And he brought both of his wives to Lyman, and they died later there. So polygamy has a very, the faces of polygamy and stuff is very interesting. And really quickly, when I was on my mission, I was discouraged trying to convert people to Mormonism. Wasn't having a lot of success, and naively, I wrote home to my brother and to my sister. My sister was gay, and I thought, well, if I just bear my testimony to her, she'll clean up her life and move on, and everything will be okay, and she'll be happy. And my brother had belonged to the Tabernacle Choir and had been kicked out of the Tabernacle Choir and excommunicated because he was preaching fundamentalism to members of the choir. And I thought, well, I'll just write to my brother, bear my testimony to him, and he'll stop believing in polygamy and move on his way. Well, he wrote me a 7-page letter, both sides, with multiple quotes from the Journal of Discourses, and as a 19-year-old missionary, that was a lot to swallow at one point in time, because I thought, well, they're just misquotes. They're just misquotes, and if you go back and read them, it's just taken out of context, it was written down wrong, all of the same excuses you'd hear all the time about polygamy. I just thought, well, during the next year and a half, I received 7 different letters from my brother. And so when I came home from my mission, I was on a mission to go to BYU and find out and study about polygamy and study about Mormonism and find out whether fundamentalism was true or not true. So I was dedicated. I took every religion class, and every church history class and every Utah history class that was a possible available not only on the undergraduate level, but also on the graduate level. I went to graduate school to find out whether fundamentalism is true. And the interesting little side note about that is that in my same class, I had as classmates Andy Ehat, Ken Cannon, and Susan Easton Black. And as a fluke of flukes, my graduate school advisor was none other than Michael Quinn. And so I went on this quest for a really long time to try and find out whether fundamentalism was true or not, and I spent just a lot of time in that. And so sometimes fundamentalism and polygamy gets foisted upon you whether you choose to do that or not. So let's move on for some questions and answers at this point in time. And one of the first ones I have before we take any from the audience was for Anne. And Anne, you made a really big distinction about the difference between making polygamy legal and decriminalizing. Could you flesh out just a few words, what would be so bad about having it legal? Is that a personal view, or is it too hard to make it legal and just decriminalizing would be a smaller baby step that would be easier to take?
Well, like I said, if you legalize it, chances are that the government would expect you to take out a legal marriage license for each new wife.
Most married people do that anyway, though.
Well, one legal marriage license is fine, but that means you put yourself under the jurisdiction of the government in that marriage. To us, generally speaking, and I can't speak for all fundamentalist Mormons, I never attempt to do that, but it seems to me that most of the time, the important commitment is the priesthood sealing or that religious commitment ceremony that you have. That's far more important to us to be recognized by God than it is to be recognized by the laws of the land. So there may be some fundamentalist Mormons that would like it legalized. I'm not sure. But generally speaking, I think, Joyce, don't we usually call it decriminalization? She's the expert on this. maybe Linda has more to add to that.
I do, and I actually think it would be far superior to legalize it, because then you would be doing a major service to the children and women in the lifestyle who now are left totally without recourse for assets and property rights and contractual rights and so forth. So a legalization would certainly go a long ways for children and women's rights.
So people from the audience, if you have any questions, please step up to the microphone and direct either to the whole panel or to a specific person if you have any questions.
I have just a quick comment. We know of a case, Candace White, after her husband passed away, she went to get Social Security for the children and was denied Social Security for the children, even though his name was on the birth certificate and he had documentation that he accepted the children as his, which the state of Utah requires that you get a paternity statement. She had to fight for those rights.
I'm Gary. I'm going to clarify something. We put together a case for the federal civil rights. Well, it was a federal civil rights case. It's called Bronson v. Swenson. It's currently before Michael McConnell and his colleagues at the Tenth Circuit. In the Bronson v. Swenson case, a couple went to the Salt Lake County Marriage License Office and asked for legal marriage license to add a single woman to the family, and it was denied. We don't really think that there's a great likelihood that this case will succeed for the sake of legalization, because if you think about it, even though legalization would have some big benefits, were the Supreme Court to grant legalization to polygamy, then they would really have to do the same thing for homosexuality. So I think there is a reluctance to let both of those scenarios become legal, which is why we keep saying, well, gosh darn, if we can't have it be legalized, then, you know, please at least stop calling us criminals. But the case before the Tenth Circuit at this point in time is to ask for legalization, and if we don't get that, hopefully we'll get decriminalization.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this is a subject that's always been intriguing to me, I guess, you know, because I've talked to Anne several times about this. You know, I've heard several references about fundamentalist Mormons. You know, we've heard from our church leaders that they say that's not really accurate, that they shouldn't refer to themselves as such. But with my experience and the things that I've studied, I would just like to add a word of warning to, especially when you talk to the press, maybe not so much you, but on a national level, because with the Warren Jeffs situation pending right now, we got an attorney general here, Mark Sherfliff, is a good friend of mine. He's going to be watching every dot and dash of this Warren Jeffs trial, and he's going to try to prove if there's any coercion at all on the part of wives in fundamentalist situations. You know that it wasn't you know that there is any kind of coercion on the part of their testimony or whatever, and so I would be very careful about anything that you say, because you know when the trial is pending right now, you know that those things are going to be thrown into the mix as far as this Warren Jeffs situation and as hot button issue as it is now. So that's just my comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to the first part of what you said, which is this chronic thing that we get from 50 East North Temple, which is that there are no such thing as Mormon fundamentalists. If I'm a non-religious Mormon or an ethnic Mormon or a cultural Mormon, I mean, there is no copyright on the term Mormon. It was given to us by our enemies, just like Christians was given to the group of Christians by their enemies. So there are Mormon fundamentalists. What that means to me is that there are polygamists out there who believe in restoration theology as taught by Joseph Smith. So it's silliness, I think. And to me, a huge part of my agenda in writing about ethnic Mormonism is to distinguish between LDS and Mormon. Mormon is a huge category, while LDS is a member of the LDS Church. So I proudly call myself a non-religious Mormon, or depending on how many beers I've had, you know, any other number of, you know, Mormon. And I'm sorry, that was kind of rude. But really, I'm just trying to make the point that, you know, the term isn't copyrighted, and I'm irked. And I know that a lot of people equate those two, but it's time to distinguish between those two groups, because the 13 million people that the church keeps touting as being LDS, 50% of us don't even go to church anymore, and, well, I'm not counted in that group anymore, but 50% are wiggling out there in some other kind of Mormon land. They're not what an LDS person is typically described as. And even fewer of those are able to go to the temple, for example. So there's a huge spectrum of Mormons, and LDS is just one part of that.
I thought I'd chime in on this discussion because it's been a really interesting debate within our newspaper about how do you do this. And, of course, the LDS Church tries to give some pressure to not use the term fundamentalist Mormons, but the stance that I've advocated at the newspaper and has become our policy is that we let people define themselves. And so that is the term, and has been for a long time, that the people themselves use to describe themselves. And it's, you know, the Baptists would tell you to not define the Mormon Church as a Christian church, and we don't let them define them that way either. So I like to throw that argument out. And I do think it's a little bit interesting. So we use the term fundamentalist Mormon, and but one little curious thing that I've noticed is that in the Deseret Morning News, which is owned by the LDS Church, they've taken to referring to the FLDS group as the fundamentalist LDS Church. And so I just think that's kind of curious.
Your comment.
Go ahead.
Your comment raises a question in my mind. How does the pressure, as you describe it, come from the LDS Church to your paper, specifically from which department of the church to which department in your paper? If you can comment.
The bat phone.
Well, it comes in the form of press releases, like a statement from them to the newspaper. And this, they really began doing this again when Big Love came out. And, in fact, if you go on their website, they'll have a big section about how there's no such thing as a fundamentalist Mormon, and they have no connection to them at all. And I find that really hard, hard to take, given that everybody's using the same scripture, for one thing, and sees the same theological roots. So that's one way the pressure comes. And then every time I write a story, I typically will get some emails from people telling me that I'm in violation, because the Associated Press does not use the term fundamentalist Mormon, or at least it's in the AP style book, which most newspapers and media use. So I'll get somebody telling me, like a USU professor, that I'm out of line for using that terminology. So you hear from members a lot, is the other way that you get the pressure. No. No, you know, we haven't changed our view of how to describe these people.
Just as a sidelight, it's interesting that Mark E. Peterson was one of the first ones to use the term fundamentalist Mormon. And then there was a time when the elders, I don't remember who it was, one of the general authorities said, well, we don't really want to be called Mormons anymore. We're the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we, all of us fundamentalists, will take the term Mormon. So, you know, there's a history behind it, and we're proud to take the term Mormon. There's feminist Mormons, non-Mormons, Jack Mormons. Why can't we be fundamentalist Mormons?
Yes, this is a question for Linda, I guess. You mentioned that the Deseret News is owned by the church, but isn't also the Tribune now owned by the church? No. I thought they bought it. So that's news. Clarify that.
Well, please. I mean, the history of the Tribune was it was actually started by the Catholics in town, you know, that were the opposite opposing voice to the Mormon church.
Yes.
And the Tribune has never been owned by the Mormon Church. The two newspapers share printing press and circulation and advertising departments, and that's where I think a lot of the confusion comes from.
We're owned by
Media News, which is a Dean Singleton company based in Denver, and he owns about 130 newspapers across the U.S.
Thank you for that. I'm so pleased that that isn't the case.
If we don't have any other questions, I'll ask the last question, and we'll finish up the session pretty close on time. Anne, that would be able to answer this best, but I would think that within the fundamentalism that there are very conservative and then some more moderate fundamentalists. And the idea of changing the law so that it's no longer one man married to one woman would require that that changing of that law in such a way that I think there's a division among the really conservative fundamentalists that do not want to for lack of a better word, get in bed with the gay people in order to change the law for fundamentalism. And then there's other people where that's not an issue. Is there a faction that are so opposed to the idea of gay marriage that they don't want any law? They would rather go to prison and have nothing else than have that law changed. And how big is that faction? That's a stereotype that I would either like to see destroyed or confirmed.
Well, that's kind of a long question, but I think if you approach the subject with the gays and the polygamists on a civil rights level, we have some things in common. We do not go into the religious implication of either one of those. We feel like the gays ought to be included in equal civil rights just like the polygamists ought to be. So we kind of address that on a civil rights level. As far as there being some conservatives and some more liberal, I think the differences mainly, there's two major differences between the groups and the independents. The independents like the free agency of not having a strong dictator-type leader. The leader in each family is the husband or father who holds the priesthood and can perform the necessary ordinances. Some of the groups vary because some of their leaders are very dictatorial and controlling. And I don't like to point out names, but we all recognize that fact in Warren Jeffs. From what the media reports, and I don't know this, well, I do know some firsthand, he has been very controlling and separated families and so forth. There are other groups that are very open. The people choose their own spouses. They are not appointed. They recommend 18 as the legal age. And they have perfect freedom to choose their own spouse. So it just varies.
Okay, thank you, everybody, for attending and participating.